Okay, so I thought to give a teaching on the prayer or the verses called the Three Principal Aspects of the Path by Lama Tsongkhapa, because this is a really good text for understanding the general overview of the important points to meditate on to gain realizations of the Dharma. Before going into that text specifically, I thought to talk a little bit about how to study and listen to the teachings and how to explain the Dharma, because I think that can be really helpful to us at the beginning for preparing our mind and so that we can really benefit from it. Okay, so it's very good at the beginning to really think of the benefits of listening to teachings so that we feel encouraged about it. So benefits like, you know, if we want to meditate, then we have to be able to know what to meditate on. To know what to meditate on, we have to hear teachings. You know, if nobody explains to us how to meditate, we invent our own, then we're going to be in big trouble, because we've been kind of inventing our own path for a long time. So we have to learn the teachings to know how to meditate, to know how to discriminate between constructive and destructive thoughts and emotions. We have to hear teachings so that we know how to counteract our disturbing attitudes, how to increase our good qualities. Okay, so when we hear teachings, the Dharma that we hear becomes our best friend and our most reliable companion that nobody else can take away from us. And here I really think of, like, all the practitioners, let's say in China or in Tibet, who were imprisoned during the communist takeover, the Cultural Revolution. Those people who had heard a lot of Dharma, even in prison, they could continue doing their practice. Even they didn't have texts, even, you know, there was nothing Buddhist around them, they could do their practice because they had heard so many teachings. So I really admire that quality in other people. So we can see there that how the Dharma really becomes our friend wherever we are, whatever happening, whether we're happy, whether we're miserable, even the time when we die. If we've heard a lot of Dharma, then even when we die, we'll know how to work with our mind and, you know, and do something constructive. Okay, so it's important when we listen to the Dharma and when we study it that we do so with the correct attitude and in a really beneficial way. So they often talk about, they give analogy of three kinds of pots, and we shouldn't be like those three kinds of pots. So one pot is the upside down pot. One side pot is right side up, but it has a hole in the bottom. And the other side is right side up. There's no hole in the bottom, but it's dirty. Okay? So to explain the analogy, the pot that's upside down, that's like when we come to listen to teachings and we fall asleep. So nothing goes in. Yeah, it's like if you try and pour water into a pot that's upside down, you know, pot's still empty. So if we come to teachings and we're nodding off, you know, it doesn't even go in. Or if we come and we're super distracted by lots of preconceptions, oh, I'm worried about, you know, how's the dog doing and, you know, what color they're painting this and, you know, there was a tornado in Illinois and, you know, and we're just, our mind's busy with all sorts of other stuff, then again, the teachings don't even go in. So it's like a pot that's upside down. So then we really miss out on a good opportunity. Then the pot that's right side up that has the hole in the bottom, that's like we come to teachings, we're not asleep, we're awake, we're paying attention, but afterwards, mind's blank, you know? And I think we've all had this happen to us, you know, like we go and listen to a teaching and then afterwards our friend comes and says, well, what did they talk about in the teaching? And we go, Buddhism. You know, because that's all we can remember. I mean, we can't remember what the teacher said. We can't remember the points to meditate on. So it's just like a leaky pot. We were there, we heard it, but, you know, mine's like a sieve and it went right through. So that's why it's very good either to take notes, or if you don't take notes, when you go back, jot down some notes, because that really helps us remember things much better. And I know for myself, one way that I studied is, I know I'm not saying that everybody has to do this, but it was one way that helped me, is I developed a system of shorthand for like commonly used terms. And then I tried as much as possible to take word-by-word notes of what my teacher said. And then I'd go back over them afterwards and read through them and try and understand. Nowadays, you know, everything's taped. When I was studying in India, you know, it wasn't taped, so we didn't have the option of going back and listening. But it's really good to review things and to take notes so that we can highlight the points in our mind to remember them. Because then that makes it easier when we sit down to contemplate the Dharma. Then the third is the vessel, you know, the pot that's right side up, and it's not broken, there's no hole in the bottom, but it's all full of dirt and grime on the inside. So then even if you pour, you know, something really delicious inside, whatever delicious thing you have gets totally polluted because of all the filth inside. So that's like, if we're here and we're listening to the teachings and we remember the teachings, but our motivation is totally polluted, you know? And so sometimes, you know, you'll meet people who come to teachings not because they really want to learn in order to change their own mind, but they want to learn so that they can become a teacher themselves. Yeah, so I'll learn and get this information. Forget about practicing it, but then I can go and teach others, and then they'll give things to me, or they'll think that I'm really wonderful. So our mind is really polluted by our motivation. Or we come and we listen to teachings just so that we can criticize other people's views. You know, and just generate a lot of opinions and views ourselves. So that's not the correct motivation. So the way we want to listen, you know, is somebody who pays attention, you know, have the ability to retain the teachings, and then especially listen with a good motivation, really to be able to use the teachings to change our mind. So I'm very suspicious. I get a lot of emails from different people who want to know where to go to study. And sometimes people will say, well, I want to become a Dharma teacher myself, so tell me where to go to study or what to read. And I'm always very suspicious of that because, you know, while it is good to teach others, I don't think that that should be our principal motivation for studying. You know, our principal motivation should be to change our own mind, because only through changing our own mind will we find any happiness and make our life meaningful. If we just learn Dharma so that we, you know, can repeat it to others and be famous or earn a living or something, then we might as well learn chemistry or physics, because we would use, you know, that information in the same way. But really, for learning Dharma, we want to have a very different motivation, so we really, you know, so you get the taste of the teachings, and it helps the mind. Okay, they also recommend listening to the teachings with the six recognitions. And again, I find these six very good for helping me to set my mind and set my motivation. So the first of the six recognitions is to see ourselves as a sick person, okay? And the second is to see the teacher as a skilled doctor, and the third to see the Dharma as the medicine, and the fourth to practice the Dharma as the way of getting cured, okay? The fifth is seeing the Buddha as a holy being whose medicine of Dharma is not deceptive. And the sixth is the methods, to see that the methods we learn are things that we pray that these methods that we learn exist and flourish in the world. Okay, so going back through them, you know, seeing oneself as a sick person. Yeah. We might think, well, I'm healthy, you know, I'm strong, I don't have a cold, I don't have cancer, everything's great. But if we look, you know, our mind is pretty sick, isn't it? Our mind is sick with the illness of ignorance, anger, and attachment. And our body is sick by being under the influence of those three poisonous attitudes. And so we're sick in the sense that we're under the influence of ignorance and karma, so that from lifetime to lifetime we just have to take one rebirth after another rebirth after another rebirth without choice, without finding any kind of lasting happiness. So if we look at that predicament that we're in, then we see indeed we are sick. You know, and that our mind doesn't see reality, that our mind is terribly confused about a lot of things and projects stuff and, you know, gets all pushed around by all of our emotions. Okay, so, you know, really for the Dharma to be beneficial to us, we have to see ourselves as sick. If we think everything is wonderful in our lives, then we won't have any real motivation for hearing the teachings. Okay. Then we see the teacher as a skilled doctor. So here the teacher, you know, could refer to the person teaching you, but ultimately what it goes back to is the Buddha, who's our real teacher. Okay? And so the Buddha as our teacher, you know, diagnoses our disease and then prescribes the medicine for us to take. So in the same way, you know, when we're sick and we go to a regular doctor, they diagnose and prescribe. Well, similarly here too, we realize that we're unhappy. We go to the Buddha and he says, you know, you're suffering from cyclic existence. And here's some medicine, the three higher trainings and the development of bodhicitta. And if you practice this, this is how you can get cured. And so that Dharma is the medicine, that's the third recognition. So, you know, when we go to the doctor and we get medicine, we don't just keep it in the shelf and look at the labels on the bottles all the time. We, you know, we have to take the medicine and put it in our mouth. And so in the same way here, this Dharma is the medicine to get cured. It'll stop our unhappiness, stop our confusion. And then fourth, we see practicing the Dharma as the way to get cured. In other words, I guess just saying, instead of the medicine being kept on the shelf, we put it in our mouth. So instead of, you know, just having notebooks full of notes and tapes full of teachings, we actually go home and contemplate what we hear. My teacher in Dharamsala, Geshe Nalandarge, used to tease us so much about this, you know, because there were no tape recorders then, but we all used to sit there with our little Indian notebooks and take copious notes. And he said, oh, you go to your room, you know, you have so many bookshelves with so many notes, but when you have a problem, your mind is totally empty. You know, you don't know what kind of Dharma to think about, what Buddha's teaching to apply to help your mind. So he said, you know, you really have to review the Dharma and think about it and practice it when you have a problem, not just kind of go back to our old ways of seeing and doing things when we're miserable. And then fifth, seeing the Buddha as a holy being whose medicine of the Dharma is non-deceptive. And so we trust the Buddha as non-deceptive because he described the exact path that he himself followed. Okay, so the Buddha didn't create the Dharma, he didn't make up the Dharma, he just realized, you know, what is, he realized what needs to be abandoned, what needs to be practiced. He saw very clearly what to, you know, how to practice what needs to be practiced, how to abandon what needs to be abandoned, and then he did it. Okay? And so through his own personal experience, you know, the Buddha actualized this. And so therefore we can trust the teachings because he spoke them with a good motivation and he spoke them out of his own direct experience. Okay, and then sixth, that the methods we learn are things that that we want to pray that this Dharma that we learn exist and flourish forever. So I think that's an important prayer too, you know, not only that we have access to the Dharma, but that the Dharma exists and flourishes in our world. And I feel very strongly that that's what we're trying to do here at the monastery, is set something up so that long after we're gone, there will be a place where people can come and learn and think about and meditate on the Dharma. So if we have to go through some difficulties in setting things up, that's okay, because our motivation is something that's long-term. And we have, you know, in our heart, the very deep prayer and aspiration that the Buddha's teachings take root in this country and that they flourish in this country for many, many, many generations, you know, long after we're all dead. Huh? Maybe we'll be reborn and come back here, you know, next life. Then everything will already be built. We won't have to worry so much about it. Then if we get clairvoyance, we could say, oh, my past life did that. That was good. But even if we're not here, there will be other people who benefit from our efforts. I wanted to also mention a little bit about the kind of teaching that we should listen and practice to. Listen to and practice. Because this is also very important, especially in America where there's such a spiritual supermarket going on. Okay, so they say that the teachings we should listen to and practice should have three distinguishing characteristics. The first is that it should have been taught by the Buddha. The second is that it's cleaned of any errors. And the third is that it was realized by the great masters. Okay, so let's go back to the first. So that was taught by the Buddha. Okay, why do we want to practice teachings taught by the Buddha? Because as I just said, the Buddha described the path based on his own experience and did it with a motivation of compassion. Now, this doesn't mean that everything that is taught in other religion is wrong. Okay? Because there's a lot of points in other religions that correspond with what the Buddha said. And so those things found in other religions we should respect and should practice because they are the Buddha's teachings, even though maybe they came out of the mouth of Jesus or Mohammed or Moses or Lao Tzu or somebody else. Okay? So like all the major religions teach ethical discipline. They all teach about kindness. They teach about patience, you know. Of course, not everybody practices that, but, you know, not all Buddhists are Buddhas either. But still, you know, those particular teachings in those other traditions are valuable, and if we hear them and they help us in to become a better person, we can consider them the teachings of the Buddha and incorporate them into our practice. If there's something contradictory, like if they're teaching inherent existence or something like that, then that part we don't incorporate, you know, because that contradicts what the Buddha said, and it contradicts reason, because when we analyze, we can prove that inherent existence doesn't exist at all. Okay, and then the quality is of the teachings is that it should have been cleaned of any errors. So what it means is that, you know, the Buddha may have taught a pure teachings, but sometimes over the centuries, things get corrupted, things get misinterpreted. We've been having a lot of discussions about that recently, you know, how sometimes different cultural practices sneak into the Dharma, and then these cultural practices, people start saying that these are the teachings of the Buddha when they aren't, or people leave out aspects of the Dharma that don't correspond with what they personally think, and they teach that to others, or they change what the Buddha said in order to agree with their own opinions. So that may have happened sometimes over the centuries. So what we want to make sure is when we hear teachings, that we've heard teachings that have been cleansed of all of that. In other words, teachings that are really, you know, can, when we hear them, we can trace them back to the sutras and the Buddha's word, okay? So that they're free of any kind of other accretions that may have snuck in, either accidentally or deliberately. And then third, that these teachings should have been realized by master practitioners. So once that they've been heard, considered, and meditated upon, then they must be passed to us through the various generations of an unbroken lineage. Okay? So that the teachings haven't just been preserved in an accurate form verbally, but the realizations of these teachings have been preserved. And they've been practiced by successive generations of people. And through these people's own practice, they've been able to establish the validity of the teachings. And so that's why it's so inspiring when we see modern day examples of real practitioners who have transformed their mind through the practice. And then that lets us know that, yes, these teachings actually do work. Okay, so we want to practice a teaching with those three characteristics. Then I just want to talk a little bit, too, about how to explain the Dharma, because they talk not just about how to listen, but how to explain it, okay? So there's responsibilities on everybody's side. So in the same way that we think about the benefits of hearing the Dharma, we have to think about the benefits of teaching the Dharma. And I think this part is included because not everybody likes to teach. You know, I have some friends and they just say, I don't want to teach the Dharma. I don't like teaching. I don't want to stand up in front of a bunch of people. And so here I think thinking about the benefits of teaching can give us a little bit of encouragement to see the value of what we do. And they say so often that the gift of the Dharma is the highest gift. And I think that's really true, you know, because when we look in our own life, what has benefited us the most, you know, I mean, I can say personally, the greatest kindness I've received is the kindness of my teachers in teaching me the Dharma, because the Dharma is the most valuable thing. So likewise, when we can share the Dharma with other people, it becomes something quite valuable. Okay, when you teach, you also have to practice what you teach. That's the really hard part, okay? Because what we know intellectually is always, always greater than what we're capable of practicing at one particular moment, at least for us ordinary beings. Realized beings practice everything perfectly, but the rest of us lapse a lot. But there's a great responsibility as the teacher to try and practice what we teach. In this regard, you know, when you see your teachers mess up, don't blame it on the Dharma and don't think the Dharma doesn't work. Just remember that your teachers are also human beings who are trying just as we're trying. Copy their good examples and leave aside the bad ones. Okay? And then they also recommend for teachers, just as students should check out the qualities of a teacher, teachers should check out the qualities of students to make sure that the students are appropriate for whatever they're teaching. Okay? So I've actually found, just in how I teach, that different audiences will bring out different kind of teachings. And I think, you know, something there is working that, you know, like if I, this text that I want to teach now, the Three Principles of the Path, if I taught it to a different group, the teaching might come out somewhat different, simply because of, you know, who the people are who are listening. And so we all co-create this situation through, you know, how well we listen, you know, if you practice it afterwards, the questions that you ask, you know, so we all are involved in creating what's about to happen. Okay, so that's just a little bit about how to listen to teachings, the kinds of teachings to listen to, and then how to teach. So this particular text by Lama Tsongkhapa, who's sometimes called Jay Rinpoche, he was a great reformer who lived in Tibet in the late 15th, early 16th century. And the reason why his teachings have become so valuable, I think, is, you know, Buddhism was introduced in Tibet beginning in the 7th century, and then there was some persecution after a few centuries, similar to the way in the Tang Dynasty there was persecution of Chinese Buddhism, a similar thing happened in Tibet. And so some lineages were lost, there was a certain amount of degeneration, sometimes people got a lot of wrong conceptions and confusion about the teachings. So then again in the 11th century they brought Atisha and then to Tibet, and then lots of people like Marpa, the great translator, went to India and brought teachings to Tibet. Virupa came from India to Tibet and brought many new lineages. So this was a revival in Tibetan Buddhism around the 11th century. Things went very well for a while, and then there were certain confusions that arose. And so one thing that Lama Tsongkhapa did is he really went back through and studied the scriptures, studied the commentaries, and he studied with masters from all the different lineages in Tibet at that time. So Lama Tsongkhapa was not sectarian at all. You know, his followers have all of a sudden established a tradition and called it Galupa. But Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, he wasn't a Galupa. He had no intention of establishing a tradition. He studied with everybody. And he clarified a lot of the misconceptions about emptiness. And he clarified also the role of morality and how important the monastic ordination was for the practice of the Dharma. So, you know, I've had the fortune to study a lot of Lama Tsongkhapa's things, and I found them very, very beneficial. I mean, I'm not somebody who says Lama Tsongkhapa is great because he's my tradition. No, because, you know, when I started Buddhism, I didn't even know about Lama Tsongkhapa. I didn't know about all these different traditions. But I've just found that, you know, when I've studied this and then when I've practiced it, it really helps my mind. And when there's confusion, you know, if you go into the teachings, he really clarifies a lot of things so that points can be very, very clear. So I think it's, you know, I've found it very, very effective. So the Three Principles of the Path is a very, very short text, but with a very big meaning. So let me just go through very briefly what the three principal aspects of the path are, and then afterwards we can start going through the text verse by verse and really understanding it. Okay. First of all, when the Buddha taught, you know, the Buddha went around ancient India, going from place to place, giving teachings to all different sorts of people. Some people he taught were already his followers, some were non-Buddhists, some were people with wrong views. He taught so many different kinds of people. Some people were very intelligent, other people weren't. So he gave different teachings to different people according to their own disposition. And these were all recorded in the sutras, and the sutras passed down from generation to generation, first orally, and then about, you know, one century BC they began to be written down. So the teachings were passed down like that, but they were all put together in a big whole, and sometimes people would read them and get very confused, you know, because the Buddha taught this in one place, and he taught that in another, and that in another, and what thing are you supposed to practice first, and what are you supposed to practice second, and what things are the really important things that the Buddha taught, and what things are subcategories of those important things. And, you know, it's very easy to get confused. And I really saw that, you know, when I went to Singapore to teach. Initially, this was many years ago. People had many different Buddhist teachings there from different lineages, and they had heard a lot, but they didn't know how to put it together in terms of their own Dharma practice. You know, they said, well, do I practice Amitabha, or do I practice Vipassana, or do I practice meditating on death, or, you know, how do I do this? Do I practice all three? Do I just practice one? What order do I practice them in? So the nice thing that happened As the teachings developed in India, especially with Lama Atisha's teachings, he wrote a text called the Lamdrun, or the light, the lamp of the path. And there he began to systematize the teachings. You know, kind of which points found in which sutras do you practice first, and then which ones, and then which ones. And then Lama Tsongkhapa further systematized those teachings. And so that makes it much easier for people to know how to practice, because if you have the big overview, let's say of the Four Noble Truths, or the overview of the the three principal aspects of the path, you know, or the overview of the gradual path to enlightenment, if you have this kind of structure in your mind, then when you hear any specific teaching, you will know where it fits in the path. And you'll know how it relates to the other teachings, and you'll know what to practice in what order, okay? Which I think is really helpful for us, so that we don't get confused. So in these three principal aspects, there is an order in which you develop them, okay? But we also train in all three, although we emphasize, you know, the first one at the beginning, the second one, and then finally the third one. So these three principal aspects, the first one is called the determination to be free. It's sometimes translated as renunciation. The second one is bodhicitta, or the altruistic intention. And the third one is the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, so these are like the three principal things, the three principal realizations that we want to gain. And if we look at all the Buddhist teachings, we can categorize how they fit into these three, and then we can see how, you know, if you have renunciation, it helps you generate bodhicitta, and that helps you generate wisdom. And we can see how, you know, if we generate bodhicitta, how it depends on renunciation and how it can increase our renunciation. And we can understand how wisdom can make our renunciation and our bodhicitta stronger. We can understand all these relationships, and that really helps in our practice. Okay, so for a quick overview, when we talk about renunciation, or the determination to be free, what we're talking about here is a mind that sees the defects of cyclic existence, or samsara. You know, the mind that sees what samsara is very clearly and says, I want out. Okay? Now, part of our problem, one of the big obstacles we have in our Dharma practice, is that when we look, our determination to be free isn't always so strong, okay? Because often what happens is, yeah, I want to be free of samsara, but I want my samsara to be really nice and pleasant too. I want good food, I want a comfortable bed, I want to have friends, I want people to speak nicely to me, I want to be respected, you know? We have all these kinds of worldly aspirations that part of our mind is still thinking will bring us happiness. So as long as we're clinging on to these worldly things and thinking that they're going to bring us ultimate happiness, then, you know, our determination to leave samsara, to leave cyclic existence, is very weak. Okay, do you get what I'm saying? You know? Because we can look, because, you know, if we're single-pointed on, like, I'm fed up with cyclic existence, I want out, then we're going to be single-pointed in, well, what do I need to get out? I need to realize emptiness. Yeah? And I need to develop samadhi, and I need to keep my vows really well, and I need to, you know, develop some love and compassion. If we have strong determination to get out, we're going to have strong determination to practice. But, you know, when we look at our mind, you know, we get distracted so easily. It's like, oh, it's so nice. Maybe I'll go lie on the beach, you know, take a break. I meditated so hard. Let's have a milkshake. You know, let's watch some TV. You know, let's do all these other things. And so, you know, somehow our energy for the Dharma gets weakened because our determination to be free isn't so strong. Okay? When we say renunciation, what we're really renouncing is suffering. Okay? We're not renouncing happiness, we're renouncing suffering. Because lots of people think, oh, renunciation means that I have to go and live in a cave like Milarepa and, you know, burn my finger off like the, you know, the great Chinese master, that's renunciation. You know, oh, I can't do that. But, you know, that isn't what we're talking about. Renunciation means renouncing suffering. And we're not just renouncing the ouch kind of suffering, but Buddhism talks about three kinds of suffering, which I'll get into in further classes. But we want to renounce all three of those kinds of suffering and their causes. Okay? So renunciation is really having compassion for ourselves. It means we want ourselves to be happy. We want ourselves to be free of misery. Okay? And then bodhicitta, the second principal aspect of the path, is based on renunciation, okay? Because renunciation says, I want to be out of cyclic existence. And bodhicitta says, everybody should be out of cyclic existence because everybody's just like me and wanting to be happy and not wanting to be miserable. You know, so I can't just work for my own liberation. I have to be able to really extend a hand and help others. But to be able to really help others, I need to get enlightened so that I have all the qualities of a Buddha. Okay? Because we, you know, we have some love and compassion now. We want to help others now. But sometimes we don't know what to do. Or sometimes we try and help and we do the wrong thing. Now, so we want to become enlightened, or we want to gradually develop the path in our mind stream so that our ability to act with compassion and act in an effective way to help others increases. Okay? So that's the bodhicitta. Then the third principle is the wisdom realizing emptiness. And that's important because in order to actually free ourselves from cyclic existence, in order to purify our mind of all defilements so that we can become a Buddha, we need to realize emptiness, the lack of inherent existence. Because as long as our mind is confused by grasping onto inherent existence and also by the appearance of inherent existence, as long as our mind, you know, is obscured by all of that, we're not going to be able to liberate others or liberate ourselves. So the wisdom realizing emptiness is the actual thing which purifies the mind and cuts the root of suffering. So that's why that one is important. Okay, so that's a quick overview of the three principles. We'll go into them more in depth next time. But I wanted to see if you had any questions so far, or comments, or whatever. Okay. There's no questions or comments?
Yeah? Renunciation, bodhicitta, and the third one
is the wisdom realizing emptiness. Yeah. So we can go into those three much, you know, deeper. And but it's good just to think about the overview.
Mm-hmm.
Why each one of those is important. Because then that gives us some energy to do the meditations that lead us to generate those realizations.
Mm-hmm. So the three principles, is it like you do renunciation first, and then when you go to bodhicitta, then you have to refer back to renunciation. But for renunciation, you don't think about bodhicitta.
Yeah, they're developed in that kind of order, but it's not a strict order. Mm-hmm. In other words, we start out meditating on renunciation, and we need some understanding of that to meditate on bodhicitta, because with bodhicitta, we want others to be free of suffering. Mm-hmm. But before we can want others to be free of suffering, we have to want ourselves to be free of suffering. Mm-hmm. So that's why renunciation comes first. Okay? And but then when we you know, it doesn't mean you only meditate on renunciation and never bodhicitta and never wisdom. We do all three. but we emphasize renunciation a little bit more at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because the stronger our renunciation is, the stronger the determination to be free is, the easier it will be to generate bodhicitta, and the more energy that we'll have for meditating on emptiness. Okay? Because if we don't have any motivation, like wanting ourselves to be out of cyclic existence, or wanting all beings to be happy and to be out of cyclic existence, if we don't have those, either of those motivations, then we don't have any energy to meditate on emptiness. Why should we meditate on emptiness? Yeah? I mean, because we don't do anything without a motivation. And if you don't want yourself or others to be free, well, why put in so much energy to meditating on emptiness, which is hard? You know, it's not easy. And it takes a lot of study, and it takes effort, and then you have to develop concentration and work with our mind that's so full of distractions and always falling asleep and, you know, full of rubbish. And if we don't have any motivation to do anything, then we won't do it. But then, you know, as you get kind of some understanding of each of the three of them, then it helps you understand the others. So even though, like, the wisdom realizing emptiness is the third one, when the more understanding we get of that, then when we meditate on renunciation, we'll begin to see that the suffering we want to be free of is empty of inherent existence. And that gives us a whole different understanding of suffering and a whole different feeling about the determination to be free. Or if we have some understanding of emptiness, when we meditate on bodhicitta, we'll see, you know, how it's possible for sentient beings' defilements to be eliminated from their minds. You know? So that deepens our bodhicitta.
So renunciation, you start with developing a passion for yourself.
Yeah.
By wishing yourself free from suffering, and then when you've worked on that, then you start working on developing a compassion for others.
Right. Right. Because if we don't wish ourselves well, how are we going to wish anybody well? You know? And I think this is a big misunderstanding that sometimes Westerners bring into Buddhism, is they have a feeling that, you know, to be really compassionate means I don't take care of myself, I neglect myself, and I have to suffer in order to be really compassionate. And that's wrong. You know, Buddhism teaches we have to have love and compassion for ourselves. We have to take care of ourselves, but in a healthy way, not in a dysfunctional way. Okay? And we have to want ourselves to be happy, but not in a selfish way of wanting my chocolate, yeah, but in a way of I want myself to be happy because I want to be out of cyclic existence. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's very important, and a lot of people in the West, you know, because of our culture, misunderstand that, and then, you know, because people here have so much problem with self-hatred, then they think, oh, I have to renounce myself to benefit others, you know, and I hate myself for being so selfish, and I'm such an evil, wicked person, you know, because I'm selfish. And that kind of attitude becomes a big impediment on the path. You know, we have to really care about ourselves in a healthy way and respect ourselves, you know, respect our own spiritual, you know, interest. I think that's important, you know. And we have a precious human life. We have the interest in the Dharma. We have to respect that part of ourself, you know, and nurture it and feed it, because it's something very, very